This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israel says it will respond to Iran's weekend attack despite growing international calls to step back. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Israel's defense chief says it's considering the next step, but says there will be a response without giving details. Israel is under heavy international pressure not to respond and further escalate the conflict. From Washington,
strength and wisdom need to be the same sides, the different sides of the same coin.
To London,
all sides must show restraint.
To Tehran itself, with Iran saying it does not want to escalate Mideast tensions. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A bakery in Gaza City has started operating for the first time in 6 months with aid from the World Food Program, providing desperately needed food in a part of the territory where a UN-backed report has warned of imminent famine. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston.
Abdulrahman Al-Jadba scored a bag of bread for his family. He says he had been forced to feed his children bread made with flour mixed with sand.
Our feeling after bread became available, it brought some sense of relief to be able to feed these children.
Israel has faced increased international pressure to let more aid into the Gaza Strip since it targeted an aid convoy on April 1st, killing international relief workers. The World Food Program says it's been using a new coordinated route to get aid into northern Gaza. It says it was able to make its first delivery to the bakery on Saturday with enough flour to make 14,000 bread parcels a day.
Pro-Palestinian demonstrators blocked roadways in Illinois, California, New York, and the Pacific Northwest on Monday, temporarily shutting down travel in some of the nation's most heavily used airports. This is VOA News. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said he would discuss a just peace in Ukraine with Chinese President Xi Jinping as the two leaders met in Beijing. He says, my meeting with President Xi will also focus on how we can contribute more to a just peace in Ukraine, Scholz said in a post on social media platform X, adding there had been an intensive exchange between the governments since his last visit.
House Speaker Mike Johnson is pushing for votes this week on aid for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan.
There are precipitating events around the globe that we're all watching very carefully, and we know that the world is watching us.
Johnson plans to hold four separate votes on the package and leaves open the possibility of significant changes from the $95 billion aid package the Senate passed in February. But he's facing outright rebellion from conservatives. House Democrats could be open to helping Johnson and may even be agreeable to some Republican measures being discussed, such as providing some Ukraine aid as loans. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Former U.S. President and current presumptive presidential nominee Donald Trump's historic hush money trial got underway on Monday. The first day ended without any jurors being picked. AP correspondent Michael Sisak reports the jury selection effort proceeded slowly.
A panel of 96 Manhattan residents was brought into court for the beginning of jury selection in Donald Trump's criminal trial. Quickly, that was whittled to about a third. As the judge asked jurors if they could be fair and impartial, more than 50 raised their hands. And then nine more exited the courtroom after they said they couldn't serve for other reasons.
The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing Idaho to enforce its ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth while lawsuits over the law proceed, reversing lower courts. The justices' order Monday allows the state to put in place a 2023 law that subjects physicians to up to 10 years in prison if they provide hormones, puberty blockers, or other gender-affirming care to people under the age of 18. Under the court's order, the two transgender teens who sued to challenge the law still will be able to get the care that they want or need. The court's three liberal justices would have kept the law on hold altogether. A federal judge in Idaho had blocked the law in its entirety, saying that it was necessary to do so to protect teens. You'll find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. UN Secretary General Guterres calls for humanitarian support and a political solution to the Sudan conflict.
Sudanese people desperately need the support and generosity of the global community to help them through these nightmares. At the same time, all parties must ensure full humanitarian access so vital aid can get to where it is needed most.
The U.S. also calls for an end to the Sudan conflict. Sudanese farmers strive for food sufficiency as fighting rages. Zimbabwe seeks to profit by mining and processing lithium. Namibia's SWAPO Youth League demands the expulsion of some top European envoys from the country.
The EU member states, it was stated in black and white again, that they regard this opposition leader as the future head of state of Namibia.
And international pressure builds on Israel to hold back from responding to Iran's attacks. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on Sudan's warring parties to ensure a rapid, safe, and unhindered humanitarian access and to protect civilians. Speaking Monday to mark the first anniversary of the Sudan conflict, the Secretary General also called for humanitarian support to the Sudanese people and a political solution to the conflict.
Over the last 48 hours, much of the world has been focused on the crisis that was generated in the Middle East. As concerning as those developments are, and the world is forgetting about the people of Sudan, today marks an heartbreaking milestone, 1 year since the start of fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. And this is more than a conflict between two warring parties. It is a war being waged on the Sudanese people. It is a war on the many thousands of civilians who have been killed and tens of thousands maimed for life. And it is a war on human rights and international humanitarian law. Indiscriminate attacks that are killing, injuring, and terrorizing civilians could amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. Aid convoys have been targeted. Humanitarian personnel and warehouses have been attacked. Women and the girls are subject to rampant sexual violence, and meanwhile, the impact of the conflict is spilling across borders. 1 year on, some 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, need life-saving assistance. Today, the International Humanitarian Conference for Sudan and its neighbors was hosted by the governments of France, Germany, and the European Union. The Sudanese people desperately need the support and generosity of the global community to help them through this nightmare. At the same time, as reflected in their commitments made in Jeddah, all parties must ensure full humanitarian access across borders and battle lines so vital aid can get to where it is needed most. They must heed the UN Security Council's call to ensure rapid, safe, and unhindered humanitarian access and to protect civilians. But the Sudanese people need more than humanitarian support. They need an end to the bloodshed. They need peace. And the only path out of this horror is a political solution. At this critical moment, in addition to global support for aid, we need a concerted global push for a ceasefire in Sudan, followed by a comprehensive peace process.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking Monday at the United Nations on the one-year anniversary of the Sudan conflict. Also Monday, the United States called on all parties to the Sudan conflict to lay down their weapons and end what National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby calls this intolerable violence. He spoke during a news briefing.
Today marks the one-year conflict in Sudan. Since fighting erupted a year ago, civilians have been forced to bear the brunt of this senseless conflict. Thousands have been killed and wounded. Women and girls have been kidnapped and assaulted. Hundreds of thousands of families have been displaced. Communities and livelihoods have been utterly destroyed. And famine now is threatening to take hold. That's why the United States continues to commit resources to create conditions for a potential peace process, to hold accountable actors who are seeking to sow more violence, and to assure that humanitarian assistance reaches the civilians who urgently need it. We reiterate our calls for all parties in this conflict to lay down their weapons and put an end to this intolerable violence for the future of Sudan, but most of all for the future of the Sudanese people.
That was U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby speaking Monday in Washington, D.C. French President Emmanuel Macron said Monday that world donors pledged more than $2.1 billion in humanitarian aid for Sudan after a year-long war that has pushed its population to the brink of famine. The Associated Press reports that Macron spoke at the end of an international conference in Paris aimed at drumming up support for Sudan's 51 million people. The aid will go to food, water, medicine, and other urgent needs, he said, without providing a specific timeline. The diplomatic envoys, UN officials, and aid agencies urged Sudan's warring parties to stop attacks on civilians and allow access for humanitarian aid and call for immediate international mediation efforts towards peace. Monday marks 1 year since the war began between Sudan's army and its paramilitary wing, the Rapid Support Forces. The conflict has produced widespread hunger as fields are laid unplanted and aid agencies struggle to reach millions of Sudanese displaced from their homes. Despite the challenges, some farmers are getting support from a British aid organization. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
On April 15, 2023, Sudanese are waking to the sound of gunfire, shelling, and the roar of military aircraft as the Sudanese army and paramilitary rapid support forces began fighting for control of the capital, Khartoum. The fighting made it difficult for humanitarian aid organizations to distribute food and hard for farmers in the conflict zones to plant crops. The spreading clashes killed thousands and displaced millions from their homes. Practical Action, a UK-based aid group, is working with farmers in states not affected by the war to produce food, fight hunger, and improve their economic conditions. The organization is supporting at least 200,000 farmers and families. Mona El-Tahir is the country director of Practical Action Sudan. She says her organization is focused on easing food insecurity.
We have a project in Al-Gadarif and Kassala. We have another project in the Blue Nile for supporting small farmers for increasing their production and productivity through provision of seeds, seedlings, and some knowledge for the farmers. And this is also successful and can bridge some gap, but at a very limited scale, because we are one of the very, very few organizations working on sustaining agriculture and farmers rather than distribution of relief.
According to the United Nations, more than 18 million Sudanese are food insecure. Most are trapped in areas of active fighting. The conflict has disrupted agricultural production, damaging infrastructure and farmers' livelihoods. Jalal Babikar is the leader of the Elahia Farmers Association. He told VOA that farmers in his area have increased production and are cultivating more land. He says using about 50 fedan of land, equal to about 50 acres, we cultivate a variety of crops, including potatoes, grapefruit, lemons, bananas, and various vegetables. This year, in collaboration with Practical Action, he says, we embarked on a potato cultivation project in Kassala State, planting approximately 24 fedan across three designated areas. Residents of Kassala State, previously dependent on Al Jazeera and Khartoum for their potatoes and other produce, but the conflict has disrupted the supply chain and the region is forced to be self-sufficient. Babika says producing more food locally has added benefits. He says our goal in planting potatoes in Kassala State is to improve the business situation of small farmers. We are planting potatoes to give farmers cheap potatoes and seedlings and to create employment opportunities for the youth in the region. Babika is optimistic about the future of agriculture in his country. However, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Walker Tak warned Monday of an escalation of the conflict as more armed groups join the fighting. El-Tahir worries that Sudan's war will hinder her work with farmers.
My nightmare is the conflict will expand to the safe areas where we have our activities. Then they will loot the harvest or they will destroy the cultivated land. And then that would be a real disastrous. And everything is expected because like yesterday they attack Al-Gadarif.
calls for UN and international agencies urging the warring parties to cease hostilities so far have been ignored. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 16th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Namibia, the SWAPO Youth League is demanding the expulsion of some top European envoys for meddling in the Southern African country's internal affairs. This after the ruling party youth wing of the criticized a recent meeting between European ambassadors and an opposition presidential candidate ahead of the coming November general election. Phil Yanagolo is a political analyst and the executive director of the Namibia National Society for Human Rights. He tells VOA's Peter Clotier that it appears the focus of the discussions during the meeting has angered sections of the ruling SWAPO party.
It depends who is saying what, and this is according to political affiliation. Well, the largest political party, that's the ruling SWAPO party, of course, it's the one that is angrily reacting against these contacts between EU member states and the opposition party leader. But on the other hand, the members of these opposition parties are supporting that.
But the meeting is regarded as an informal lunch to discuss the situation in Namibia. And some analysts are saying this happens usually in a lot of countries around the world where they engage both the government or the ruling party and opposition parties in election year. So why are SWAPO members so displeased?
Well, they are displeased for various reasons. First, the meeting was held, and it is put in black and white, that it was held in order to discuss future Namibia EU relations with this opposition leader. Secondly, the EU member states, it was stated in black and white again, that they regard this opposition leader as the future head of state of Namibia. Now, this is interesting because the election haven't been held yet. How do they know that he'll be the future head of state? Thirdly, this meeting came several weeks or maybe perhaps even days after it was revealed that this opposition party secured over 100 campaign vehicles, electoral campaign vehicles, and it is not known, and this opposition party declining to give information as to who is funding it. Fourthly, again, about 2 weeks ago, this opposition party leader himself threatened that they are going to fight SWAPO in the same way as SWAPO had been fighting the apartheid regime during the liberation struggle in the 60s and 70s. And everybody knows that SWAPO was then fighting with weapons of war, which means then it is clear that this party is willing, is preparing perhaps, and that's what the people believe here now, that is preparing perhaps to overthrow the government. And they, in fact, are saying so as well.
The SWAPO Party Youth League did not only condemn the diplomats, but are calling for their expulsion from Namibia. Isn't this an overreaction?
No, it happens also in Namibia, some 30, perhaps 29 years ago, when the Finnish ambassador to both Namibia and Zimbabwe had contacts with the opposition parties in this country. And the Finnish diplomat has met, these leaders from this opposition party. And then he was immediately declared persona non grata by then President Sam Nujoma, who was the first president of Namibia. So I think it happens in many situations like this.
Phil Yanagolo is the executive director of the Namibia National Society for Human Rights. He spoke from the capital, Windhoek, with viewers Peter Clotty. Zimbabwe, with its rich deposits of lithium, is spending its hopes for economic recovery on mining and processing the mineral, a key component in batteries for electric vehicles. Zimbabwe has Africa's largest lithium reserves and is the world's sixth largest lithium producer and supplier. Columbus Mavunga reports from Kama TV, where investors have poured millions of dollars into their lithium venture.
This former tin mine that closed about 30 years ago due to declining prices has now reopened as Kamativ Mining Company and is processing lithium. Boy Joseph Dingane, a traditional leader from this poor area, says the reopening of the mine has changed the area's fortunes.
This project has changed my community entirely through employment. That's very, very important. Children are going to school. Children now are not dragging themselves. They are going for it. So it has changed the community completely. And I wish it to go ahead, go on like that and employ more people.
The Kamativ Mining Company says it employs about 1,300 people and has exported 50,000 tons of processed lithium, known as spodumene concentrate, since it was launched about a year ago. Zimbabwean and international investors spend $100 million to make the site a working lithium mine. Meng Yang is one of the investors. Meng Yang says the Kamativ Mining Company has contributed significantly to Zimbabwe's finances, paying more than $8 million in taxes. With the completion of Phase 2 imminent, he says, we expect this project to create more employment opportunities and increase our tax contributions towards the development of Zimbabwe. The cost for Phase 2 of the mining's development is $150 million. President Emmerson Mnangagwa hopes Zimbabwe will benefit from rising demand for green mineral used to make batteries for electronic vehicles. Mnangagwa says his government will continue to enforce a ban on exporting raw lithium so that the country raises more revenue through the sale of processed lithium.
Our country, Zimbabwe, is determined to sustainably exploit this strategic resource to realize socio-economic development for our people, as well as enhance value for investors and indeed give an impact to the world towards addressing climate change crisis. We shall value add our resource for our economy and unlocking maximum benefits from our country's abundant mineral resource. Government will therefore continue to support the drive by Kamativ Mining Company towards the processing of lithium ores into concentrates.
But Farai Magu, director of Center for Natural Resource Governance, an organization working on improved governance of natural resources in Zimbabwe, says the export ban is not being strongly enforced. He says his organization has witnessed tons and tons of raw lithium leaving the country.
The companies that are exporting lithium from Zimbabwe, at first, they were exporting lithium in open trucks. But because of the criminality around the lithium trade, now it seems they're under instruction that they must either cover it in tents or they must put it in containers. You no longer see lithium being exported in open trucks. We should have seen increased liquidity in our economy if we were charging correctly. So most probably, the lithium that is leaving Zimbabwe, I think less than 50% is being declared. The rest is leaving the country illicitly.
Zimbabwe's Minister of Mines, Soda Jemu, has denied those claims, asking for proof of the allegations. Jemu said exports of processed lithium will increase in the coming years, and he believes mining will become $12 billion industry for Zimbabwe. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Kama TV, Zimbabwe.
International pressure is building on Israel to hold back in responding to Iran's attacks, but many Israelis are calling on their government to retaliate forcefully. For VOA from Jerusalem, Linda Grastein reports on the intensifying debate.
Iran's attack with hundreds of missiles fired simultaneously was unprecedented. So was the international cooperation to intercept them, with the U.S., Jordan, and Britain working together, say Israeli security officials. As the international community urges restraint, some in Israel say the Jewish state must respond.
I think that we cannot leave this open file without some retaliation. But the kind of retaliation is going to be measured in the sense that Israel doesn't want to lead to a regional war.
Israeli media reports say two former chiefs of staff in the war cabinet, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, wanted to strike back at Iran while the Iranian attack was underway. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said no. Other Israeli intelligence analysts say the damage was limited and Israel can choose not to respond further.
I'm sure Israel will be able in the future to retaliate in Iran in a different way. We have a lot of capabilities, and I think it will be much more devastating for the Iranians if Israel succeeded, and Israel has to contribute to that in order that it will work, succeed to change the architecture of the Middle East in a way that will be understood that Iran is with its proxies, but all the others are actually cooperating against Iran and its proxies.
Iran's attack came as Israel is under growing international criticism for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza that has left hundreds of thousands of Palestinians facing famine. The U.S. has been pushing Israel to accept a ceasefire that would lead to freedom for the remaining 129 Israeli hostages that Hamas militants took hostage on October 7, although it's not clear how many are still alive. There is concern in Israel that retaliating against Iran could lead to even more pressure on Israel to withdraw from Gaza before it has reached its goals. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
The National Intelligence Service in Burundi has detained a journalist, her family told French news agency AFP on Monday, raising new concerns for press freedom in the East African country. Sandra Muhoza, 42, a journalist for online outlet La Nova Burundi, was arrested Sunday and is being held in the economic capital Bujumbura, a family member said. The government of President Evariste Ndayishimiye, who took office in June 2020, has been widely criticized for failing to improve Burundi's dismal human rights accord. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
One of the leading causes of disputes, even divorce in marriages. This week we get tips from financial experts as well as couples' testimonies on what works and what doesn't when it comes to handling love and money. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-minute VOA newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA,
your trusted source for news.